Okay, and we are back. It's hour number two on this Friday evening. Without any doubt, one of the most important stories we've covered in a long time on this program is the truth about the Port Chicago nuclear explosion. An atomic bomb was intentionally, from all the data we can gather, set off in 1944 at Port Chicago in San Francisco Bay on the east side. And this is a major story. What a cover-up. And we were able to have Walter Wilkinson on last night to give us a large amount of the background data and the truth of this incredible event, which killed 321 Americans. Mostly, the majority were black U.S. Navy servicemen who were there loading at Port Chicago munitions, bombs to bullets, everything in between, onto ships, two ships that were heading off to the Pacific to support the U.S. war effort against Japan toward the end of World War II. Port Chicago, the destination and location of the first nuclear blast in America. It's hard to believe, but the data is frankly overwhelming. It took place virtually one day short of one year from the Trinity test, the first formal and publicized test of an atomic bomb in New Mexico. This is a big story. And I got an email today I'm going to read in just a minute or two. First of all, Walter, thanks for coming back for part two. We have other things to cover tonight about this really extraordinary story.
Well, Jeff, again, hello from the desolate badlands of northern Wyoming.
Yeah. Very good.
Where I live now.
Now, the story last night was absolutely fascinating. And we part of it covered the idea that the U.S. government, the military, whatever, the government, was there to film this event. It took place a little after 10 at night in the dark, but the flash and the illuminated mushroom cloud and all the rest of it was captured on film. And several people have seen this film. You saw the film, and I had an email today from Philip. I'll stop there. That's his name. Thank you, Philip, for sending this in. He said, hi, Jeff, I saw that film, too, in 1999. I know the exact year because I was living in suburban Washington, D.C. at the time. The video was run by Jerry Pournelle on his blog site. And if memory serves, Jerry got the video from the Huntington Beach, California Public Library. The archived blog still exists online, maintained by his children. But I just searched it in both the Google channel and the blog's own search engine does not turn it up. I'm sure it was there. Perhaps if Mr. Wilkinson contacts Frank Pournelle, I'd say that's obviously Jerry Pournelle's son, he might be able to track down that film or a copy thereof, a video copy of it. So it's out there somewhere. It was released, and then it was obviously removed from circulation for clear reasons. So go ahead, Walter. Let's pick up the story. First, any comments on this email from Philip?
Well, I'll follow up on that, and I hope we get some more leads. In our very first conversation towards the beginning, you identified two things you were interested in. One was whether, the evidence that the Port Chicago blast was an atom bomb and not conventional munitions going up. And the other thing you mentioned was the two-thirds of the 321 fatalities were black Navy enlistees.
Right. So,
and the way to, I think, a effective way to get to that would be to introduce the architect of Port Chicago, and that was Captain William S. Parsons. And I had forwarded a picture to you of him.
It should be up there. Go to photos. And, it's there right at the top. That's not it. It's not there yet. Hold on. I'm going to make sure we get that up there. So, yeah, go ahead. How does this captain get involved with setting this whole thing up? What's the background on Parsons?
Uh, he, He was a captain then. Shortly after World War II, he had been promoted so many times he was a rear admiral. And how often does that happen? He became a rear admiral even though he never commanded a Navy ship.
Exactly.
And how often does that happen? the key point is that from the beginning, the atom bomb project was always a Navy project. And we don't think of it because we think of the B-29s, if that was... You know more about this than me, but the huge bomber that dropped the atom bomb was a B-29, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Over
Super Fortress.
Only became available later in the war.
That's
and
right.
At the beginning of the war, they didn't know when or when or if it was going to be available. So it was always envisioned as a port, as a harbor busting bomb, and. Japan had built a whole bunch of heavily fortified island fortresses in the Pacific, and the U.S. didn't have much of any intelligence about what sort of defenses were there. One of the large-scale changes which happened over the war was that people finally realized that air power was going to be more important than naval power. So during the 1930s, the Japanese built the biggest, most powerful battleships ever built, and other countries did too. But they were kind of obsolete by the time they were launched. And the Battle of Midway showed that, aircraft carriers were the most important asset. And the battleships were almost in the way. They were, so these heavily fortified island fortresses were going to be the target of the harbor-busting atom bomb. And one place this shows up is in a famous document which bore the signature of Albert Einstein and went to President Roosevelt, and where he was, though he didn't write the document, but he affixed his signature to it, and opinions vary about how influential it actually was, but when it's asked, what was Albert Einstein's contribution to the war effort anyway? He was never at Los Alamos. But, and it's always been described as a nuclear torpedo. Well, there never was any nuclear torpedo because of the bulkiness of the bomb. It wouldn't work any better in a torpedo. So it seems that the great minds.
Well, look, and just to enhance what you're saying, look at pictures online of the two bombs that were dropped: Little Boy and right. Fat Man. Those two bombs look nothing alike, and there's a very strong reason to suspect that the first one, dropped, I guess, on Hiroshima, was of German, basically German material was used in that bomb, captured when U-234 surrendered in the Atlantic at the end of the war. Very interesting angle on that. Think about that. One of the two bombs was actually a German bomb. And then you might ask yourself, well, did Germany have an atomic bomb? And the answer to that is apparently yes. Hitler did not want to use it for reasons that we could go into, but that's not for this program. They did have it. They could have used it, but for reasons I we'll talk another time. He didn't. So that uranium actually was processed. Very interesting story. Was apparently used in one of the two bombs.
Okay, yeah, I agree. That's we can wonder why Germany didn't use it. But so the great minds like John von Neumann and Edward Teller and others were basically going to cross that bridge when they came to it. When they saw the atom bomb was tested and was actually usable as a weapon system, then they would figure out how they were going to sneak it into one of these great port facilities in the Pacific. So a great name was Rabaul, which is an island with one of the finest harbors, natural deep water harbors in the South Seas. But even more important was the an archipelago called Truk, which is spelled T-R-U-K. And we didn't have any knowledge of, we knew that a lot of resource was being channeled into the defenses, but we didn't really know how strong they were. So at the beginning of the war, a harbor-busting bomb was very relevant. And John von Neumann was the overall chief scientist. He was one of the world's great mathematicians. He was at the, like Albert Einstein, he was at the Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies, but he was the headmaster or president or whatever the name was. John Neumann didn't go to Los Alamos very often because he was extremely phobic about flying in airplanes, and he refused to do so. So when he traveled to Los Alamos, all of the in all of the states connecting New Jersey and New Mexico, the state troopers were told that in the middle of the night, a very important person will be roaring through here at well over 100 miles an hour, and you are not to stop them. So John von Neumann set a land speed record from New Jersey to New Mexico, which will never, ever be met. Well, anyway,
All right. We
actually have some documents about one of his visits there. He huddled for 2 days with William S. Parsons, who has a very bland-sounding title, like a chief of munitions or something. But right. William Parsons, who at that time was only a captain, was U.S. Navy's highest-ranking representative, basically, on this project, which was a naval. At first, it was going to be a naval weapon. So the documents show that von Neumann and Parsons huddled for a couple of days doing intense brainstorming because von Neumann had studied and was understanding something about explosive shock waves, which were underwater. So, again, a naval weapon. And Parsons was the Navy's prime representative there. So an interesting indication of how early on Parsons was at Los Alamos. He was the Los Alamos property previously had been a summer camp for boys, a kind of a dude ranch.
Really?
And,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's an interesting little footnote.
Yeah, and that was Oppenheimer's entree to New Mexico. He came from an extremely wealthy family from New York City, but his parents had him stay in New Mexico, one of these dude ranches for boys. And there was a pond on the property, and William Parsons was involved with building pipe bombs, which had enriched uranium as one layer inside. There's a buildup of several layers, but he did the initial experiments with implosion, I guess, of the world. And, of course, the plutonium bomb, which was the advanced technology one, was a plutonium implosion device. And we might remember that there was a time when two spies were executed in this country, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were electrocuted. The name of the book about that, I think, was called the Implosion something or other. But supposedly, anyway, so from that modest experiment of using the pond for doing pipe bomb experiments, Parsons and the scientists there, so this changed the world, really, you know. So little boys might, naughty boys might do experiments with pipe bombs. And I think it's interesting that back when there were a lot of serial murderers in this country, It was a good thing to try to do retrospective analyses of their childhoods to see that if there are any patterns there. And boys who later became serial murderers or mass murderers, there are two things. They were known to cruelly torment animals like dogs and cats and others, and they would make pipe bombs. So Parsons had overall responsibility for the engineering of the atom bomb. And including
excuse me, Walter. I don't know how he how he rates. How did he end up in that position? He's not a physicist per
That's
se.
Right. He was an engineer, and he I was saying one of his fortes was testing. He was a hands-on engineer.
So he built the structural part of the bomb, pretty much. That was his job. The actual building,
and
physical structure.
He also had responsibility for seeing that it was delivered to its target. So
Got
I think
it.
You're,
right.
it was a broader range of responsibilities than you suggested just now.
Well, we have a picture, and I'm waiting for the webmaster in Brazil to show up to put it up. We'll have it up at some point shortly, maybe
sure.
soon. I've got the picture.
Sure.
It's already been sent to him, but he's...
Yep.
out of communication
yep.
right now. Now, also,
okay.
if you go to look at photos, there's a new picture up there since last night. It's a picture of Oppenheimer standing out in the middle of, I guess, the New Mexican desert in New Mexico, standing by some old twisted rebar there. I don't know what that's about. Another explosion of some kind.
That was the Trinity explosion, yes. And the person standing next to him.
That's the residue of it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The person standing next to him is General Groves, Leslie Groves, who was the overall engineering chief for the Manhattan Project.
Got it.
And an earlier project. Okay, go ahead.
Very interesting little footnote here that you sent me.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer's diet, that's crazy, if that's true.
Yeah, you remain a vegetarian, aren't you?
Yes. Yes.
I thought you would find that interesting.
That is. Well, we got to tell everybody what you said. He's got here a note that says, Oppenheimer, whose diet consisted 100% of cigarettes and chicken livers his entire adult life. Now, that's not exactly romantic Hollywood stuff, but cigarettes and chicken livers. Okay.
Yep. Well, he came from a Jewish family, and that's kind of a traditional Jewish
I
food.
Get it.
And
yeah.
I think as an adolescent, maybe he, and also his smoking habit came from smoking a pipe on the Dude Ranch, and starting that time in his teen years, he was had a very very bad tobacco habit. Anyway, so. Captain Parsons, if you look at the Wikipedia article for him, it goes on and on and on, and it's frankly kind of hard to believe that one has never heard of this guy. He was, the thing he is kind of famous for is for the Hiroshima uranium bomb dropping. He was the one in the airplane. So the bomb only was armed while it was in midair, you know, part of the way to the target.
And, so he armed the bomb. Parsons actually armed the bomb.
Yes, he personally,
very interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, if you want to look him up, everybody, it's William Sterling Parsons. William Parsons, Parsons, and there's quite an interesting profile of him on there. Go ahead.
But being sort of chief hands-on guy for the atom bomb was one of only three war-decisive technologies where he was the engineering chief. So in addition to the atom bomb,
wow.
if that was not enough. Yes, if that was not enough, he was always chief of the proximity fuse. And that's not something I knew about until recently. But some people will rate the significance of the proximity fuse higher than the atom bomb, which came at the end of the war when Japan was a defeated nation, and we would have won anyway.
But I still think, Walter, just my opinion, there was no reason for that. And I think most people listening have entertained that concept. What the hell for? Why?
Right. And I have read that another person who disagreed with the decision to use the atom bomb was none other than General MacArthur, who, if I'm not mistaken, had been promoted to a 5-star general first time in American history.
Huh.
Okay, I'm just an amateur, nobody.
No, that makes sense. Douglas MacArthur.
I don't want to get off the subject, but MacArthur was the one who, after the surrender, went to the Royal Palace and met with the Emperor.
Yes.
And MacArthur was well over 6 feet tall, and the Emperor was about 5 feet tall, and he was trembling. And MacArthur offered him a cigarette, and they smoked together. So anyway, Parsons. So the proximity fuse was used on land, sea, and air. And General Patton was quoted as saying the U.S. won the Battle of the Bulge because of the proximity fuse. I don't know how that worked. But the number of shots you would have to take in trying to shoot down an airplane, for example, was radically reduced because of the proximity fuse.
Mm-hmm.
So Parsons was the chief on that one, and also on radar. And the U.S. was about 10 years ahead of radar development in the Japan War. If you remember the truly great war movie from Germany, Das Boot, there's a scene where the captain, the Caesar Ruff, and the Allied submarine killing ship comes after them,
mm-hmm.
and the captain he says, it seems incredible that they would be able to find us in seas like this. But that's because we had radar. So there were these three war-winning technologies, which William S. Parsons was the hands-on chief engineer for all three at the
radar,
same time.
Radar, proximity, and the atomic bomb.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
He should have a place in history far different than that he
exactly.
certainly has now. I wonder
and
if that's intentional, if they covered it up.
Because he was the architect of Port Chicago.
And that's four, then. All right.
Four
things, yep. Yeah.
Yes, it's a little broader than that. So if you read the other book I have on the a picture of it, there's a thumbnail of Daisy Herndon's book, which is absolutely superb, and it's actually a better place to start than Peter Vogel's book, I think. But her book is richly illustrated with facsimiles of documents from people like Parsons to people like Oppenheimer, and in the structure Parsons reported to Oppenheimer. And these are, yellowing around the edges. They were typed on, looks like manual typewriters by a secretary. And
sure,
how good was
sure.
that security? But
well, what a great research job she did to find all that material.
Yes.
That's, I don't know how you'd even go begin to start looking for it. And her book came out 2 years ago. So, by the way,
completely.
William Parsons, that we're talking about now, this brilliant engineer, the proximity fuse, the atomic bomb, Port MacArthur, and then radar. And the guy,
yep.
he died in 1953 at 52 years of age. And yep. Bethesda. He died now. What did he die of? Do we know?
Heart attack. What else?
Oh, there you go. Same old story.
He's probably a heavy smoker like the men of that era. In fact, I'm looking at the picture now of Oppenheimer and Leslie Groves at the bent, twisted metal of at Trinity site, and they both look like they have cigarettes in their hands. But that was typical.
I see that.
So, to broaden what you said just a little, I was sort of overemphasizing a person's involvement with testing, and there are documents which in Daisy Herndon's book from Parsons, and it's so early in the Manhattan Project, he's saying, look, if we're going to go forward with this bomb project, we are going to need some test facilities, kind of thing he would say. And people had been suggesting, well, how about out in the desert, you know, how about Nevada, which is where it moved to or eventually. But White Sands was good also. And Parsons' rebuttal was, it's going to be a naval port-busting bomb. And to test it adequately, we will have to set it off in a naval port facility somewhere. So you know where this is heading, right? But this isn't just conjecture. There are documents which show this, and in Daisy Herndon's book, you can see facsimiles of them.
That is incredible. You know, in a way, that's almost the ultimate treason when you think about it. To do that to Americans. You'd think they would have taken it to South America and tried it out down there. Something
but
like that.
But that would have been out of. I think they want to keep it within U.S. boundaries because there is so much at stake.
Control is everything. I get it. Yeah.
You know, they couldn't allow it to fall into the hands of any other country, basically. So I had that thought, too, but they probably had that discussion, you know. Later Admiral Parsons was Daisy Herndon. One of the things she does is she compares the construction timeline of Port Chicago to that of White Sands, New Mexico, and they're kind of comparable, and they were both kind of built at the same time.
Huh.
And so it gets more sinister here, because it wasn't just that this existing facility, Port Chicago, was used as this place to intentionally kill Americans to see how lethal a weapon it was going to be. It was built from the ground up specifically to be a test bed for the first atom bomb.
Incredible.
Now, well, it can get more incredible. So, two-thirds of the fatalities were Black Americans, African Americans.
Right.
And Daisy Herndon herself is Black, so there's an additional dimension of interest to her book. And
I would say that's doubly fascinating. I had no idea.
And she says that for a time she had a correspondence going with the with none other than Peter Vogel. And I think she may have gotten interested in the explosion after her initial might have been in the mutiny trial after the explosion of the Black dock workers who had a work stoppage, not surprisingly. And there's much to say about that. Oh. If you go to a source like history.com, there are many articles about that trial. Many years later, they were all pardoned. And the NAACP was in, it was working at that time. And the chief attorney was a very young attorney named Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, became the first Black Supreme Court justice. So So I don't know if the Port Chicago Mutiny was the very first case of his career, but it was one of the earliest ones. He was a very young man at that time. So that's part of it, but that's fully documented elsewhere. What Daisy Herndon points out is that at that time in World War II, the Navy was still racially segregated, and the captains, the brass, did not want black serving on Navy ships. Now, the Pollyanna explanation of what changed was that Eleanor Roosevelt, who was in fact a friend to the black people, spoke to her husband, the commander-in-chief of Franklin D. Roosevelt's. And of course, we know what a warm, loving relationship they had. They didn't. It's one of the reasons I'm very skeptical of this. But for some reason, Franklin Roosevelt had a slogan which he started putting out to the nation, which went, "The war effort needs minorities." And that was really quite revolutionary at that time. And an idea he came up with supposedly was he knew what kind of resistance there was from the Navy to have black people serving on Navy ships. So he thought, well, is there anything on shore they could do? So his first suggestion, which in retrospect seems really insulting, he said, well, you know, the Navy has brass bands, and they have some of the, you know, very best jazz musicians. So how about, having more? Isn't that insulting?
Yeah, and, it's terrible. Yeah.
It's kind of hard to believe.
Yeah.
So you could ask, why did the war effort actually need minorities? Well, a facility was set up near Chicago, Illinois, coincidentally, and it had a name like the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, something close to that. And some black men were brought in from Chicago, where else, and they were given training to be Navy personnel, and there were four areas where they were giving training, and only one of them was loading ammunition onto Navy ships. And the morale among the black workers at Port Chicago immediately before the explosion was extremely bad, because they felt they had been tricked, that it was a bait and switch. And the only thing they seemed to be wanted for was loading ammunition onto Navy ships.
Hmm.
So it may have been another. And there are documents where William Parsons refers to black people in the most antiquated and odious stereotypical insults. The best thing he called the black workers was low quality workers, but it could get much worse than that.
Sure.
Yeah. So it may be that the reason, and Daisy Herndon doesn't suggest this, but I'm going to. She comes very close to saying this without saying this. It may be the reason that slogan existed, that the war effort needs minorities, is that they had in mind stocking Port Chicago, their test bed for the atom bomb, with black people. So when many people were intentionally killed, the people whose lives were worth less would be the ones. And I think if you read Daisy Herndon's book, I think that's what it looks like.
Very good. Well, thank you for being so kind and recognizing her extraordinary research and authorship of a book that really has few equals. And this is an area that is just not known. Now it is.
Yeah, an interesting thing about Daisy Herndon, she considering the quality of her work, I would have guessed her professional background is that she's a emeritus professor at some prestigious university. I think her book is that good. And it is so well documented. She not only has a superabundance of footnotes, all of her footnotes are numbered in, Jeff, yes, her footnotes are numbered in Roman numerals. And what does she
scholar.
Say about her? She says about herself, she's a former school librarian.
This is that's quite a story, just in and of itself. Daisy Herndon.
Yep.
Well, bravo to her. Is she still with us?
Well, I'm not sure. She had a online presence until a certain year. I'd have to look it up.
Well, the book came out 2 years ago. If you ever run across her or anything, it would be nice to have her on to honor her efforts.
I agree.
That's very important.
I agree completely, but I looked for some contact information, but I so far I haven't seen it.
Got it. Okay. Well, this is all extraordinary material, and it really is unknown, and I'm not being dramatic about it. People, Americans don't know anything about Port Chicago, and the German submarine U-234, to talk about an interesting designation, U-234, was captured after surrender in the middle of the Atlantic or thereabouts, and when Dönitz ordered all his submarines to surrender when hostilities ceased in 45, it had on it 1,234 pounds of enhanced uranium. Now, that uranium was enough to make a bomb, apparently. And it's thought by many that one of the two bombs dropped on Japan might have well been fueled with that German processed uranium. Go ahead.
Yep. Well, to shift gears a little, I think I said what I wanted to about William S. Parsons.
So he's covered.
He's the greatest weaponeer in world history.
Hold on. You just said something that is an extraordinary compliment. The greatest weaponeer in world history. And I think there's a very strong case to be made for that statement. I think you're probably correct. Extraordinary things he did. He was a genius, obviously.
Yeah, he burned out at age 53, though.
But they didn't give him the credit because maybe he wasn't with the right group, you know? I don't know.
You know what? Well, that doesn't exhaust the list of his accomplishments. So after World War II, the Navy had a program called Operation Crossroads, where they took a bunch of obsolete Navy ships and they took them out into the Pacific, and they dropped bombs on them. I don't think a hydrogen bomb was available yet. And to actually gain more information about how effective atom bombs were going to be, but also as to terrify other countries, probably. And William Parsons William Parsons was the chief of that also.
Amazing. That's a homegrown genius. That he has no ink. He's been covered up, hidden, certainly obscured, and not given just due at all.
Because it would bring up the subject of the intentional slaughter of black people at Port Chicago.
Yeah. I got it.
Yes. No.
You can't do that. You can't pull that kind of an operation off and not be fully aware, obviously, of the racial issue. So that would do a lot to darken his reputation. I get it.
Yeah. It would mean opening an old wound, especially at this time when race relations since the Obama administration are getting worse and worse. And we have this presidential candidate who's only... qualification seems to be her gender and her supposed race, you know. It's at that high a fever pitch.
Right, right. So, she's Indian, but the latest is, in case you haven't heard, there's a lot of apparent evidence to suggest that her father is not black at all. He's Irish. So maybe there's no black at all involved in the camel, which is what I call her.
Yeah. So to switch gears just a little, Jeff,
yeah.
with the time available, could we go back to the page with the pictures on it? You navigated your listeners to it last time, and I found it really interesting that you found it interesting, the picture of Edward Teller at Los Alamos holding this extraordinary document.
And, absolutely fascinating to me.
Well,
yes.
But, you know, I was so impressed by how you picked up on something, your intuition picked on something before you had any background information about what was happening there. So for those who weren't here last time, the author, Peter Vogel, picked up at a church rummage sale the document you are seeing Dr. Edward Teller holding right there. That's it. That is the document, yeah. The history of the 10,000-ton gadget.
Pull and up the photos, please, and under Williams, Walter's name there, and you'll see it. I'm looking, where is it? One, two. Well, we have Parsons at the top now. It's the next-to-last image, right above Daisy Herndon's book. It's a photo of Teller right before he exploded at Vogel,
yes.
who took the picture. This is an amazing story. I hope you can hear last night's program. It's in the archives. It's certainly there, everyone. It's
yes.
quite a story. Go ahead.
Yes. But so Vogel kind of ambushed him and, under false pretenses, asked him for an interview at his office, and
yeah.
he agreed.
Yeah.
And so Vogel took this picture and handed him the document, which is a capsule summary of the lessons learned and the data acquired from the explosion of the atom bomb at Port Chicago.
That's what Teller is looking at right there. It's a photo copy, so to speak. It's a copy.
No, it isn't actually.
Is that the original?
I think it is, because look how it's folded.
Folded
so, Jeff,
very strangely, yes.
What does that remind you of? Does that remind you of anything?
Was it
an origami? Well,
okay. Oh, origami. Okay, that works too.
No. I was joking. What you're saying
there. It's very cleverly folded. Anyway, go ahead.
But not really. It's the size of a shirt pocket, isn't it? So the person who purloined it from Los Alamos, very, very illegally, because it's... it isn't marked top secret, but it's a summary of our atom bomb accomplishments to date. And if this had fallen into the hands of our enemies, you know, that would have been uh-huh. it would have been terrible. So the photo technician who took this out of Los Alamos during the time of war without permission was really taking a chance. Vogel says it was just taking a souvenir, but I have difficulty agreeing with that. I mean, that was a very, very severe...
No, that would be an espionage charge if somebody
yes.
got caught.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But...
Just to recap real quick, Vogel was thrown out of the office by Teller right after this photo was taken, within minutes, a couple minutes, whatever. And Vogel left that piece of paper with Teller. I think that's what you said. So
he left
did
it. Well,
Vogel have a copy of it? He must have.
I think he arrived at Los Alamos with a photocopy and the original, which and because of the way it's folded, I think it would be a bit of an insult to hand a photocopy to Dr. Teller. Dr. Teller, yeah. And I think that was the original. And when he was leaving, he went around to the security office, as Teller had ordered him to do. And he turned in a photocopy of the document, which he wrote on it, property of Peter Vogel, and he signed it. And he also says that later he donated the original of that document to the Los Alamos archives, which I think was very clever and very wise on his part, because it was safer for him to no longer be the custodian of this document. And there was kind of a nuance there that they know for sure he's no longer the custodian of it because they are now. So he was much safer. But
he's
anyway,
protecting himself, sure.
Yes, yes, yes. But at Los Alamos at that time, there was a fence, a security fence around the facility with armed guards. But people were not checked to see if they're carrying anything in their shirt pockets when they were leaving the front gate. And Vogel describes this in his book, Last Wave from Port Chicago. And there was a Soviet spy master at some point, maybe he defected to the West, but at one point some Soviet spy master commented on his successes with getting important technical information out of Los Alamos. And they said the best thing that ever happened to his team was that the workers were not checked to see if they're carrying something in their shirt pockets. And that's why you see this document folded the way it is.
I get it. Oh, fascinating. He just put it in his pocket, shirt pocket, and walked out.
Yep.
Wow. Do we know if, did Vogel keep any other copy of this? The original stayed with Teller. That's what we're thinking. Vogel had a photocopy. And then he turned that into the museum to protect himself. Do we know anything else about that document?
I think he says he turned in the original to the Los Alamos archives.
Ah, okay.
And I think you're
so
seeing
that's
it right
Teller
here
with her. That Teller has to be holding a photocopy then, right?
No,
because
no,
he
the
kept
original.
It. Didn't you say he kept it?
No.
Teller
kept
didn't. It?
No. Teller told him to go to the security office, which he did.
Oh,
and
he gave it to him.
Photocopy.
He said, "Here, turn this." Okay. All right.
Yeah, in his anger, Teller, shoved it back at him.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a picture. What a story.
And I've
okay.
noticed, Jeff, that, well, there's one thing I need to note. Let me refresh the page here. But the link, okay, there's Captain Parsons.
Parsons is at the top of the page now, yes.
But the link to the treasure trove of Port Chicago documents has been deleted. So I'm hoping that will be restored.
It's there on my page. Let me reload it here. Yeah, it's there, and I'm going to see if it... Underneath your name, it says, The Truth About U.S. Atomic Bomb. Then it says, The Treasury of Port Chicago Data. And then it says, Photos.
Okay, I'm
so,
in the wrong place. Okay.
The Treasury, okay. If you go and guess off the home page, that's where you need to go, top left.
Yep. Got it.
And it's there. It is there, and it is working. And the Treasury of Port Chicago Data is truly exactly that. It is a treasury of historic data. So please go through that. And Vogel's book is in there in PDF form, all the chapters. This is really great history.
Yes, I think it's the first time in about 20 years that there's a publicly available download link for his book or any of those other things.
Well, thank you for this. It's quite a contribution. All right. Anything else you want to mention? Oh, you were going to talk about how the two Japanese cities were chosen to be nuked.
Yes. And I think that would be a topic which...
Let's do another. Chapter in this. We'll have you back soon. And we'll do that.
Because
there's a lot more to this. You have really immersed yourself in something that very few people have any idea exists. Daisy Herndon, we want to honor her again for her work. That's an extraordinary amount of work. And she was just a librarian? Was that it?
She says she was, she describes herself as a former school librarian.
Oh, geez. Incredible. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Walter, very much. We will have you back on again in a few days, and we'll do another chapter in this incredible expose of real history that is not talked about.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and thank you for your service over multiple decades to humanity.
Well, thank you very much. I couldn't do it without you and people like you. There have been some wonderful people on this program over the years. So thank you, Walter. We'll talk very soon.
Okay.
Great
bye
job.
Now.
Good night.
Bye.
That is really what makes this particular privilege I have all the more fun, to go into areas like this, history that virtually nobody understands or knows about, and to find it so well presented. And I wish I had the time. I would read Daisy Herndon's book right away. That's a great one. All right, hold on, ladies and gentlemen, and we will be right back with another hour for you.